Hey, welcome to a new episode of Last Call Baseball, number 147. I'm Dorian, and I'm rubbing the hairs on my chinny chin chin. What's going on with this international baseball? There's something going on with Major League Baseball, New York City. Where is baseball going? Why are you asking so many questions? Is baseball in a existential crisis? It's expensive. If you have kids, if you have nephews, if you have nieces, if you're a young person, you want to play baseball, you want to play softball, it's not cheap to play baseball. People who don't like baseball are saying, oh, look how low the TV ratings are for the World Series every year. But on the flip side of that, we have record-breaking attendance to games in person. The players are better than ever before. Yes, Shohei Ohtani is a better player than Babe Ruth. It's no longer controversial. Next week, the Los Angeles Dodgers and the San Diego Padres are going to start the season in South Korea for the MLB Korea Series. March 20th and March 21st, the Padres and Dodgers are playing in South Korea, both games starting at 6 a.m. on ESPN. I'm going to watch the games on DVR. I am not getting up. I am not getting up at 5:55 a.m. to watch baseball for an hour or two, or not even 2 hours, an hour before you got to go to work or you have to start work. I'll watch it on DVR because I don't care if I know the score. I'm going to watch the game because I want to know how players did. Then last week, during spring training, they had the MLB Dominican Series where the Boston Red Sox played the Tampa Bay Rays in the DR. The Dominican players and just the Latin players in general for both the Red Sox and the Rays loved it. We had the World Baseball Classic last year that was played in all over the world. I can't quite put my finger on it, but something's going on. Something exciting. Someone else made news. The Miami Marlins. Did you hear the Marlins are going to allow you, all seven of you that go to Lone Depot Park? I'm joking. It's a beautiful stadium. It really is. To go to Lone Depot Park, you can bring flags, drums, musical instruments, anything, almost anything you want, but you just can't bring in pots or pans, or I think you also cannot bring in air horns. Maybe even bring in a xylophone triangle from your music class in the fifth grade, because the Marlins are no dummies. I don't like that organization, but the Marlins are no dummies. They want to help recreate the atmosphere that they had at Lone Depot Park during these international tournaments, the World Baseball Classic, and even the Caribbean Series last month, the Serie del Caribe. Is this making baseball fun? Is it making it fun enough for you to go more than you probably would? End of the day, baseball, like any sport, it's an entertainment. I'm paying you money to go see the product, or I'm sitting at home giving you my time to entertain me. You better put something good on the field. I don't see how you bringing your violin or your recorder from the third grade to Lone Depot Park is going to help the Marlins win any more games. Is going to help the Marlins create a better World Baseball Classic-like atmosphere on a random Thursday night when they are hosting the Milwaukee Brewers. Or a boring Sunday afternoon game with the Kansas City Royals. The Marlins generally do not put a good product on the field. And the last time they genuinely tried was 2017. I'm not going to go through the whole roster, but the outfield in 2017 consisted of Giancarlo Stanton, Marcelo Ozuna, and Christian Yelich. That is an all-star outfield circa 2017. Amazing. They broke it up. And right after that season, Jeffrey Luria, the previous Florida/Miami Marlins owner, he sold it to Bruce Sherman. Bruce Sherman brought in Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter was the chief executive officer of baseball operations, whatever the heck his title was. And Jeter tried to make Miami the New York Yankees of the South. Love him or don't like him, Derek Jeter had a vision. He knew exactly what he wanted to do, but he wasn't allowed to follow it through. That's why he looked around. He's like, look, Bruce Sherman, we've torn this down. We've improved the scouting. We've improved the coaching. We've improved things as an organization. Now is the time to invest. Bruce Sherman said, not happening, Captain. Derek Jeter was like, quote, This was not what I signed up for, end quote. Derek Jeter's not going to be wasting his time with losers like the people at the very, very tippy top of the Miami Marlins. And then the universally acclaimed Kim Ng, the previous general manager of the Miami Marlins. The Marlins wanted her to come back after the 2023 season. They exercised the mutual option. Kim said, Bruce Sherman, it's been real. I appreciate it. Quote, it's become apparent that we were not completely aligned on what that should look like. I felt it best to step away, end quote. Derek Jeter, classy man. Kim Ng, classy woman. They're like, we want nothing to do with Bruce Sherman and the Miami Marlins. You know what would be really funny? If I learn how to play the Spanish guitar like Paco de Lucía, the legendary guitarist from Spain. And if you have no idea who Paco de Lucía is, go to YouTube. Paco, P-A-C-O, D-E, Lucía, L-U-C-I-A. A man touched by a higher power and sent to earth to say, you are here to play this instrument and to bring joy to people. If I learn how to play the guitar half as well as Paco de Lucía in the next week or two, I'm going to go to Lone Depot Park, try out the Marlins' new policy of bringing in your triangle recorder and your Spanish guitar and just play it. Just play the guitar behind home plate because you know no one's going to be there. What would people think? You're just playing this amazing Spanish guitar and they're like,
too high.
Ball three.
Foul.
And there I am being, blah, 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 and I'm just like playing. I don't know where I'm going with this. The point is, the Marlins' new rule change for Lone Depot Park is not going to change the atmosphere of that because they don't put a good product in the field. We have to invest in interesting storylines, in talent, and a good production. Our next guest knows all about that. This week, we're joined by special guest Kathleen Belcher, Artistic Director of the Moores Opera Center at the University of Houston. Kathleen, welcome to Last Call Baseball.
Thank you.
Kathleen, you've done theater work in Madrid, in London, in Milan. When is Florida Man, the musical, going to come out?
I don't know. That's a great idea. We'll get on that one next. That's ripe with theatrical possibility for sure.
And I ask that because you have a history of Florida. You graduated from Florida State University. You've spent a lot Correct. Of time in what I believe, and I'm not the only one, the most beautiful beaches in continental U.S., the Gulf Coast. I think it's fantastic that someone who spends this much time in Florida is able to do all these creative work and also work and live abroad.
Yeah, I've been really lucky with my career. I grew up in South Florida in the Fort Lauderdale area. Went to elementary school in Pembroke Pines, Florida, and then my parents moved out of the state, and then they came back. So I've been in. It's Florida. The sand is always in my shoes. So, and it's a place that I love going back to. And like you said, I went to Florida State for my undergraduate work. And we go, my family has developed a love for Florida because I drag them down there as often as I can. I am a beach girl through and through, and spending as much time in New York as I do is even though it's an island, it is not the same. It is not anything close. So, but I'm lucky that I get to sort of go out into the and see lots of different corners of the world with my job, and still get to come back and enjoy the beaches in Florida.
I agree with you. I always push back whenever you hear someone, especially now that we're like getting close to political season in the U.S. of Florida, how messed up it is. And I always tell them the reason why Florida and these very soon to be coming to your local theater characters, Florida Man, Florida Woman, Florida Daughter, is because of the, what is the act called? It's the Sunshine Law, where it has to be public knowledge, the most insane arrests or whatever, because in a lot of states, people don't really believe this, that in the U.S., there's a lot of states that restrict journalistic access to public records and criminal offenses as well. So I'm like, the reason why Florida is a great comedy troupe, great comedy mine, is because of good American laws like the Sunshine Law.
Exactly. Access to everything as it should be, so that we can all hear about the crazy guy that does whatever he does with the alligator.
Or yeah, the crazy guy that wants to murder his lover with a spaghetti spoon. Like it's just
Exactly.
I love Florida, and especially as you were saying in New York City, Florida is the best in the winter. That's why New York is no, Florida is overrun by New Yorkers in the winter, especially like basically right around now. But
Yeah, exactly. So it was funny. People always used to say to me, they said, "Why do you like, why would you want to live in Florida? There aren't any seasons." And I'm like, "There are seasons. There are tons of seasons. There's love bug season, there's hurricane season, there's football season, and there's everything else." So don't ever let anyone tell you there aren't seasons in Florida.
yeah, I'm happy that I found a fellow Florida champion here. The reason why I reached out to you is because you helped co-write and produce and direct a baseball-themed play, and it was called A Baseball, A Musical Love Letter. Tell us where that inspiration came from to do a play or a musical on baseball.
Yeah, I'll call it a cabaret. Imagine if Ken Burns wrote a cabaret about baseball. That's what our show is.
It would be 9 hours long, though.
It would
And
be
yours was like an hour and
90
20
minutes.
minutes, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it was weird. It was, like a lot of good creative ideas that happened during the pandemic. This was one of them. And since I work in the theater mostly, I was sitting around worried I'd never work again. And some strange reason, I had this idea to type baseball and opera into a search engine. And this random piece popped up. It's the Brooklyn Baseball Cantata, which ironically is not in the show, but it was the one. It was a this great musical number that like grabbed me, and I was like, we could write an opera about baseball. We could write a show about baseball. So I called my dear friend Dan Ragazzi, who works with me at the Metropolitan Opera, who is also a baseball fan. And I said, Dan, what do you think? Should we write this? And he said, let's do it. So we had nothing but time, and we, went down a rabbit hole. And Dan, God bless him, is the stats guy, and he would. I was out finding music, and he was finding stats, and we married it all together and ended up with what I think was a really, really moving and wonderful show that ended up being mostly about the Negro League baseball teams, and how they came to fruition, and the struggles and challenges and everything that those people faced. So we got lucky. I don't know. It was
Yeah, no,
some.
I enjoyed it. It came out in 2021, and you guys also put it on again just last year. And for those of you who don't know, it's quasi baseball history because it goes from like the mid to early 19th century up until about the 1950s when Jackie Robinson and then Bill, not Bill, excuse me, Buck,
Buck
I was
O'Neill.
Buck O'Neill. I was about to say Buck Williams. Excuse me. Yeah,
Yeah.
thank you. I enjoyed it. The only thing I would have said to help improve it would be to inject I don't know, like something like Ted Turner when he managed the Atlanta Braves for one game before he was
Yeah.
told he couldn't do that in 1970s. But maybe that was too cosmopolitan, for
I
I'm
don't
teasing.
know.
I always
No.
like those little wacky parts about baseball history.
Sure, absolutely. We did too. So it was hard to edit. Our show started out really long, and we're like, "Ew, we got to cut this out and cut this out and cut this out." So there's lots that was left on the editing room floor, including my beloved Brooklyn Baseball Cantata. So look it up. Go find it on the internet. It's 13 minutes long though, but it was a really fun piece.
Cantana, is that Italian for something? Cantana, something but song or bell?
It's a song. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Another thing about the show, when the actors were doing the scene for the 1919 Black Sox or the White Sox, excuse me, I always remember, and I really did try to look this up, but I couldn't find it. But I remember I read somewhere, because that always is, as Peter from Family Guy says, grinds my gears about the 1919 White Sox is apparently. Who is it? Charles Kaminsky, the owner. Yeah, Charles Kaminsky, the owner of the White Sox at that time. The reason why they kind of went that rabbit hole of maybe they did, maybe they didn't throw the 1919 World Series is because in 1917, when the White Sox won the World Series, he took their World Series bonus, withheld it, and donated, air quotes, to the American World War I effort. Because they were like, oh, you should be patriotic and give it to the American Red Cross or whoever he donated it to. And so there was already in their back of the mind, along with all the other cheap parts. But I don't know how you could get like jokes out of it or a nice song out of a very, very cheap and mean man.
You probably could, though. But I mean, that's fascinating. I hadn't heard that. I hadn't heard that story. So it doesn't surprise me, knowing what I know about him.
Spending so much time in Florida, where did baseball come into your life? Because I'm guessing that the Miami Marlins, the Florida Marlins didn't come around until like the early 90s, and then Tampa Bay didn't come until even earlier than that. Where did your love of baseball come from? Was that spending time outside of Florida?
Yeah, well, my dad was a minor league baseball player, and he didn't make it very far out of the, he didn't make it out of the minor leagues. And he sort of instilled his love for baseball with both me and my brother. I spent many a day watching my brother play little league baseball. But then my parents moved to I don't know, when I was in high school, I discovered the Chicago Cubs on WGN. And I watched like every game. And then I had a dog that I named Rhino after Ryne Sandberg. So I came to baseball kind of late, but my dad was really the one that sort of steered me that direction. And once I had really started to learn more about the game, we could really talk about it in a different sort of way, which was it was great. My dad, who I love dearly, but wasn't the most communicative all the time. But we found common ground here where we could really, talk about life and things in general through baseball. So it was beautiful that way. And that, so by then my parents moved to Atlanta, Georgia. So I got to go see the Braves play. And that was my first Major League Baseball game. I was probably 25 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in person. I mean, other, I watched it on TV, but that was it.
It's funny because I came about baseball because just like you, television, but I was of the TBS generation. And so I became a huge Atlanta Braves fan. And that's when they had just started rocking out and winning pennant after pennant and going to the World Series seemingly every single year. You'd come home and there were, because at that time, the Cubs were still playing in the daytime when they played at home. And so by the time you got come home, it's in the middle of a game on GN, but they always lost. And you're like, these guys are boring and they have ugly uniforms. I mean,
No,
these are the thoughts of like a 14-year-old boy, you know?
yeah, for sure. But I also had a huge baseball card collection too. I started collecting baseball cards then too, which I still have, which is sort of silly. I don't know what I'm gonna do with it, but I did become a big Braves fan, and I watched them with Smoltz when they had all the good the huge pitching staff, Steve Avery and John Smoltz and that crew, Tom Glavine, all those guys is when I was really watching a lot of Atlanta Braves baseball.
I do love that the drama part about not just baseball, but just high caliber competition, especially in the playoffs, and everything is just so much more important, even though the game doesn't change. It just seems like it's more important. And I am generally not a fan. I don't want to say not a fan. It's not like I don't like, but I'm just not really into like opera and the theater. However, I have seen a couple of plays. Where is that line of distinction, or what interests you and what doesn't interest you when it comes to opera versus the theater that you would see in the West End in London or on Broadway in New York? Like I remember seeing Spamalot, and there's a lot of singing in that, or even what is it, Book of Mormon? Hilarious,
I
but
love
it's
Book
not
of Mormon.
opera. But they're still singing and they're still pushing forth a storyline. Where, why are there? What is that distinction between opera and just theater?
Well, I mean, there isn't really one. So, I mean, opera is just, I mean, it's big musical theater that's not amplified, right? So if you think about, and it would have been the popular, like back in the time of Mozart, it would have been the what was playing at the West End, right? So it was music and theater for everybody. It was what everybody went to see. We've sort of gotten out of that, and opera's sort of gone down an elite path, but or elitist path people think it is, and it's not really. I think opera's gotten more and more accessible. There's opportunities. If you go to the opera, they project the translation of the words either on a screen above called a super title screen, or there's a lot of theaters now that have them in the backs of the seats, so you can just read as you're going along, so you know what the story is. But it's basically the same thing, although I think it's on a bigger, because opera is so big and grand, sort of the emotions are the same, right? So they sort of everything expands a little bit and becomes larger than life with opera. But a lot of those stories I think are still very relevant today. It's just taking a risk and going out and listening to it. But I love musical theater too. So I'm not going to lie to you. On my day off, if I'm going to go to the theater, I'm far more likely to go see a musical like Book of Mormon than go see another opera, just because I think it's for me, it's a little less like a like work and more of an escape for me. But I, you know, there's qualities of both that are they're very similar. It's just stylistically differently, and one's amplified and one's not.
It's true. I remember when we had to watch the Where are the Jets? Where are the Jets? What's that? West Side
Oh,
Story
West Side Story,
in
yeah.
school, and it I think it was like music class, or I don't know, some kind of artistic creative class, which I'm a big fan of. But I'm like, people don't go around talking this way in 19, what is it, 50s, 60s New York, Harlem. I think that's when. What is it? What's the play called?
West Side Story,
West
yeah.
Side Story. And I'm like, I see that. In all due respect, I'm like, you go around like that, you're gonna get beaten up. But what is it about? I'm genuinely curious. Like, what is it about that form of expression? Because all art is a form of expression, whether it's words, it's singing, it's dancing, it's colors, which the New York Fashion Week was just a few weeks ago, Paris Fashion Week just ended. What is it about you that just hooked you, much kind of like a baseball, but in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in music. They tell me when I was little, I was really interested in. I asked a lot of questions about classical music. Where I heard it, I don't know. But they bought me these. They bought albums for me because I'm old, and I would lay under the end table because the speakers for the console were under the end table in the living room, and I would lay under there with the book open, and I had little paper dolls that I would like move around to the music. So I don't know. I've always been sort of interested in music and moved by music and intrigued by it. And I just gravitated that way. I think it's in my DNA. I thought I wanted to be a performer when I was younger, but I discovered I had horrible stage fright. So decided that wasn't the route for me. But you know, still couldn't imagine my life not being involved in theater in some way. So yeah, I guess that doesn't really answer your question probably, but yeah, it's just always been there. It's always been a part of me.
Love that, because you're able to do something you've liked since a very young age. Someone who's like you've written plays, you're a director. What's the process of like sitting down? Because when you for operas, you have these operas that have been around for hundreds of years, and I know that there are operas being written and produced, but obviously not at the scale as it was 200 years ago. How do you
Oh
sit
no, they
down and
are.
go? Oh, they are.
Yeah. Oh yeah. In fact, the Metropolitan Opera just did a couple. They've done quite a few really big contemporary new pieces in the last few years. So yeah, they're still getting done.
But
But
how
sorry,
do
I
you,
didn't mean to
no,
interrupt. Go
oh,
ahead.
no, this is talking. It's fine. How do you sit down and go through all this catalogs of all these operas and say, this is what I want to help direct or produce or whatever? Because when I think of it like baseball, I'm like, every day there's a new product coming, there's a new game. But with a lot of these, the plays that are most famous in culture are hundreds of years old. So how do you decide what you want to do, what you want to direct? And do you ever want to do like, let's do a different angle? Not everyone has to go up there with big, 19th century pre-French revolutionary hair and all that.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So for me, I like to find pieces that I think I have something to say that I and I'm a big fan of modernizing an old piece. Like for example, there's a piece that I'm directing right now at the University of Houston. We're doing a Mozart opera called Così fan tutte. And it is very old school opera, right? But I moved it to and it's set, you're gonna love this. It's set normally in Naples, Italy, but I have moved it to Naples, Florida, and set it in a resort. But I can still tell the story, right? I can still talk about the relationships and how these people love or don't love or argue or tell their dramatic stories in a through a contemporary lens. So that I think it helps newer people that maybe don't go to the opera very often. It makes opera feel a little less threatening for them than say like the big Marie Antoinette wigs. If they see people up there dressed like them, maybe they can relate a little bit more. So I'm a big fan of doing that. But what I do is I'll look at the piece and go, do I have anything to say about this? No. I'm not going to direct this. Or yes, I love this. I love the music. I think I know what I'm going to say, and that's what I want to do. So that's sort of how, that's where I go. That's right. But you're right. It's a vast amount of music, and there's some stuff that I naturally gravitate to, like Mozart and Rossini, and stuff that, then there's stuff that I don't, which is like Wagner. I don't do a lot of Wagner. Not that I don't want to, but it's just not my normal, I don't know, just doesn't grab me the same.
I like how you're bringing these older plays into contemporary, because people forget that they themselves were just putting on contemporary plays. It's not like they were like doing crazy biblical stuff, or when dinosaurs were roaming, they were like, this is how people dress, this is how people act, and we're just going to do, it's kind of like a pop song today.
Yeah,
we're not going back. And I would also, I would hope for this reinterpretation of Mozart's Tutti fan tutte, that it ends on the play, it ends before 5 o'clock, because if it's set in Naples, everything dies. Not that, no, that's the wrong word. Everything shutters by 5 p.m.
So true.
It is so, I love that town. It's beautiful. I don't really love it because I haven't been there in a long time. The last time I was there was to go to I believe it's called the Naples Museum of Art for a Monet exhibit they had. Because, you know, Monet made 3 trillion paintings, and they're all over the world. But I went to go see that driving across the Alligator Alley from Miami out there and saw it. But then we were there, and afterwards we went down there, I think their version of like Lincoln Road or whatever it is, or Las Olas. And it must have been 6 o'clock. And I mean, there was nothing open.
yeah, that's true. Yeah, but, these people, they're young people in Naples. So it's really not very, very true probably, but that's okay. We'll pretend. Willing suspension of disbelief.
Oh, you know what? Now I remember there is a play that I thoroughly enjoyed. I've watched it live once at college. I saw it at Florida International University, and I've also seen it on VHS many years ago. A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Oh, yeah, that's a great, yeah.
Could you readapt that and make it like A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to like a baseball stadium, and all the horrible traffic or the bus or the subway, something.
You totally, that would be fun. Yeah, you probably could.
It was so
that.
Funny. It was a great play, but it's not as good as a movie, because then when you watch it as a movie, you're like, oh, this is a play. It works on stage, but it really didn't work in movie, because towards the end, it was just like zany, like little musical that they were just chasing each other around. And right. It was like, oh, but actually seeing it, you're like, this is a very fun, quippy play.
Yeah, it's a fun one. But that's a good idea, though, to update or you'd have to change it quite a bit, but it could probably work. Anything is possible.
Are you able now to just basically see any baseball games now? Or are you just too busy with teaching and putting in directing?
Well, I'm hoping to go see, we just moved to Houston. So, from Kansas City, so which is a big baseball town, and Houston's a big baseball town too. So, we're looking forward to going to see a game. I think we're going to try and go opening weekend actually, and go see the Astros. I've never at one point in my youth, it was my goal to go to every baseball stadium, and I was doing really well. And then they started building lots of them, and I gave up. But I haven't been to Minute Maid. I think it's Minute Maid, right? Minute Maid
right.
Park. Yeah. So I haven't been there yet. So that'll be fun. We're gonna go.
That's exciting, because I know that just last weekend the University of the Houston Astros held a college baseball invitational tournament that the University of Houston was part of. LSU went there. I think that Rice or LSU was there, and yeah, it was amazing seeing these top notch college baseball programs playing at a professional baseball stadium like Houston. I always love asking our guests the fantasy question. I know this is going to be a very, very hard on the University of Houston and all the wonderful theaters in all over Europe. But if I was to pull Kathleen Belcher away from the creative world of theater and plays and anoint you as the new commissioner of Major League Baseball, what's one or two things that you would implement to change the game in your view as better, and to be a good director for baseball?
Well, collective bargaining aside, we'll skip that part. But honestly, I would get rid of all of those new rules that try to make the game faster. The pitch clock and the mound visit stuff. I'm like, just why are we trying to fit it into a TV schedule? I like let baseball be baseball. It's the leisurely pace is part of the game. And I that's the first thing I do. I'd be like, revoke, back, none of that, gone. Because I think it's, I don't know, I don't think it's changed the game for the better. And I think it's just us trying to, why baseball shouldn't try and compete with the NFL and the NBA and that speed and that kind of quality. It's a different game. So let the game be the game. It's, you know, it's poetic in the way that it plays out, and it takes as long as it takes. And that is what I would do.
Okay, Commissioner Belcher, I would say this. I'm going to speak to your production business sense here.
Okay.
If you have a play that's 4 hours long, you probably can only put it on once a day. But if you have a play that's 90 minutes long, I'm not saying baseball has to be there, but a shorter play, you can do a 12 o'clock on a Sunday and then the matinee at 4 or 5 o'clock. And the thing is that with baseball in itself, a game, you're right, it's poetic. It has its own pace. It speeds up, it slows down, but they play for 17 consecutive months. They play 3,000 games in a season. And it's not like, oh, I missed the Braves and Twins game on Tuesday. Ah, well, I'll just watch them the next two games on the homestand. And that the lack of scarcity is what bothers me with baseball, because it's just wave after wave of game. Like every single game you have, every single day you have 17 games. And it almost, I don't want to say it cheapens, but I think that in our world where everyone is now, multitasking, whether we think they were good at it or not, that's why I would say it's a good thing we try to shortening the game. Sounds crass, but maybe even if we cut the amount of games from like 162 games to like 100, a nice round number, and we still have no pitch clock and nothing else.
I could get behind that. I really could. Because I mean, and you're right, because it's a really long season and it's a ton of games and it's hard on your body and it's hard, you know, if for an, you know, no other reason than that. That and I agree, there is a, you know, demand, supply and demand does come into play. And if there are fewer games, then there's more demand. So I could maybe get behind that.
You see, even the creative
Assistant
commission.
Commissioner of Baseball.
See, the director wants the show going on all the day, all the time. But then the producer part of it is like, all right, let's start counting those coins.
Yeah. You've got a good point. You have an excellent point.
And so, Commissioner Belcher, we know that the job of being commissioner is in the center of the universe, New York City, obviously. It really, and I love New York City, but it annoys me how self-centered it is sometimes. When we go watch a play on in Broadway or off Broadway, and then the next day go to a baseball game, whether it's the minor league game or one of the Yankees or Mets, where would you share with us where you like to go for coffee, drink, food, that a local place? It doesn't have to be the fanciest or the worst place in the world, just some places that you enjoy.
Places that I enjoy. There are a couple places that I really enjoy. I really enjoy Death and Company in the East Village, which is a it's a cocktail bar that it's not really a speakeasy because it's not hidden. It's not one of those ones where you have to go through a phone booth with a punch and a code or whatever. You know, it's you know, it's a you walk in. But I really like I love that place. And it's small, it's cozy, it's cocktail theater is what it is. So those bartenders, I mean, you walk in and it's like it's this array of things. You know, there's bitters and glasses and bottles, and it's just beautifully arrayed. And watching them make a drink is like watching theater. And they make a really mean drink. Like that's the best base the best basic daiquiri I have ever had in my entire life is at Death and Company. And they don't have a lot of food though. That's the only problem. So you can only go and have like, I can only go and have like two drinks and then I have to be done. But that's probably my favorite go-to place. Yeah. Death and Company. And their menu changes. So I don't even have really you know, a favorite standard drink that they, cause they change them seasonally. But the other fun thing about going there is that you can tell one of the bartenders that, you know, I like Amaro. I like drinks that are bitter, or I like, and they'll just make something for you, which is super fun. So Death and Company, East Village.
But it's always a good idea to have some food in your belly before you go drink, because then you slip down a very, is there a good local, is there a good some food place that you enjoy?
Good place. There's a good, I can't remember the name of it, so it's not very helpful, but there's a really good soup dumpling place that's right around the corner from Death and Company, near NYU. And it's the soup dumpling place, which it escapes my.
It's definitely not the kebab place that used to be by NYU. That used to be, what is it, like $2 a kebab?
No. But the best cheap slice of pizza, Sacco Pizza on 9th Avenue in Hell's Kitchen.
You know what? The pizza place I really like is Sophie's. It's up by, I believe it's Tudor City. It's by the Trader Joe's, like on 58 and First Ave. They have Detroit style pizza. Phenomenal. I've been a convert over the last few years for Detroit style pizza.
Okay, I'll have to try it next time I'm in the city. I'll go check it out.
And I'm going to give you one more advice, even though, what am I, self-interviewing myself? One more is Thai food. Thai food is phenomenal, but there's this place in off of Houston. I believe it's in no, it is off of Houston in First Ave, no, First Street. Chomp Chomp. It
Chomp.
is Chomp Chomp. It is not, it is unlike any other Thai place that you usually, your local Thai place. It's
Writing it.
phenomenal. Chomp Chomp off of Houston.
Got it.
Everyone loved it. It was a huge hit. It was, and they have set things on the menu that you're like, again, this is not from your local Thai place. So that's my contribution to the delights of New York City and the pre, what is it? The pre-show dinner. What is
Yes, I
it?
love it. I
Yeah.
love it.
I mean, that is a bit of a hike going from Houston up to Broadway, but it can be done.
It can be done. It can be done.
Okay. Okay. Kathleen Belcher, I want to thank you for your time. Let us know where we can see some of your work or something that you're going to produce soon that we can go and support the arts.
Not super soon, but you will be able to see my work in New York City next spring. I'll be directing The Barber of Seville at the Metropolitan Opera. So you could see that I think it's in April of 2025. If you happen to be in the Houston area, you could come and see Così fan tutte at the University of Houston at the beginning of April 11th through 14th. I'm here and there, and you can find me wherever the tides may take me, I guess.
Thanks to Kathleen Belcher for joining us. When I make it down to Death and Company, I'm going to take a picture and post it on our social media if you want to follow. And if you don't follow. Even though I'm not having one of those delicious cocktails from Death and Company during this episode, what I have been drinking is this Witt beer. Witt, no, Witt beer. It's German. A Witt beer from Fifth Hammer Brewing Company, a good American local brewery in Long Island City, New York. Even though this brewery is across the river in Long Island City, I can't wait to check out Kathleen's recommendations in Manhattan. I want to thank you for listening to Last Call Baseball. Be great and get home safe.